From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. And we begin today with Illinois U.S. Senator Dick Durbin. The 78-year-old has been a member of Congress since 1983, in the Senate since 1997, and he's been the Democratic whip, the number two Democrat, since 2005. Durbin is also chairman of the Judiciary Committee, and a lot of our conversation today touches on topics under his jurisdiction, including ethics at the U.S. Supreme Court, the legitimacy of the court, and the slower pace of confirming President Biden's judicial nominees owing to the long illness of Senator Dianne Feinstein. We also talk about Ukraine, the debt ceiling fight, and Durbin's long relationship with Republican Senator Lindsey Graham. In order to make our schedules meet, I spoke with Durbin Monday afternoon in downtown Springfield, in the building that used to be the headquarters of the State Journal Register newspaper. Because of that, we're not taking calls live for this part of the show, but as ever, let us know what you thought by emailing us. The address is talk@21stshow.org. That's talk@21stshow.org. Senator Durbin, welcome back to the 21st Show. Thank you for making the time to be with us today.
It's good to be here.
I want to begin with the United States Supreme Court. In the last 2 months, we've learned that Republican billionaire Harlan Crow has spent millions of dollars on luxury travel for Justice Clarence Thomas and paid the private school tuition for a nephew Thomas said he was raising as a son. And that's all thanks to reporting by ProPublica. What changes should the Congress be pursuing in response to these revelations?
Well, first, the American people have to understand what's going on here. The Supreme Court of the United States, nine justices, are in a unique position in our federal government. It is the only part of a branch of our government that does not have a code of ethics as to their conduct, nor are they subject to the same type of scrutiny, investigation, and review that every other person in the federal government faces. In fact, those nine justices at the highest levels of our court have a treatment policy that is much different than other judges, every other judge, district judges as well as circuit judges. So many of us have thought over the years that it's time for them to come into the 21st century. 10 years ago, we ran into exactly the same thing. Justice Thomas, involving Harlan Crow, had been involved in some activities that he hadn't reported. Well, he filed an amended return. Several of us wrote letters to the court saying, take care of this. They didn't do it. Now it comes around again, and it's worse.
You invited the Chief Justice to come testify before the Senate Judiciary Committee, which you chair. He refused. What does that say about, I mean, are not other branches of government supposed to answer when Congress comes calling?
Well, I can tell you since 1990, more than 90 appearances by Supreme Court justices for everything under the sun, changes in the law, their budget in the court, whatever it needs to be, they were happy to walk across the street and appear before Congress. But when it came to something this fundamental, the record of Justice Thomas and the rest of the court when it comes to ethics, the Chief Justice refused. I tried to handle this in the proper way because we're dealing with the highest level of our judiciary. I reached out to Judge Dow, who had been in the Northern District of Illinois, to let him know I was going to send this invitation ahead of time. I didn't want to surprise him. He didn't make any commitment and said it was up to the Chief Justice. But my hope was that the Chief Justice would realize that, like it or not, this is the John Roberts Court. The record that he's writing will be a record that he has to live with in history. And I thought that the circumstances were so compelling that he would take this initiative and come over and appear before us and straighten out this mess.
So is that the end of the story? Is there no way to compel his appearance or testimony? I mean, is there, you know, you could start zeroing out aspects of their budget or something like that, or is that a bridge too far?
I think that's a bridge too far, but this isn't the end of the story. Everything is still on the table. So we sent a letter to Mr. Harlan Crow saying, explain what you did with Clarence Thomas over the years. Let us know. The letter was supposed to be, we were supposed to receive a reply yesterday. We didn't receive it. I don't know if that means there will be no reply or it will come later. But everything is literally on the table. As far as subpoenaing Mr. Crow, I think if he is not going to voluntarily cooperate with us, that's not out of the question.
What about the justices? Is there, I mean, is that
History is our guide here. And just to put the cards on the table, There's only one other time in 1953 when the House Un-American Activities Committee decided to subpoena Supreme Court Justice Tom Clark for what they considered his un-American activities. He told him to go jump in the lake in no uncertain terms, and that was the end of the story. So there's never really been a test. The bottom line is this: whatever Congress does in response to judicial activity is going to be subject to review by the judiciary. So we have to take this thing in an honest and forthright fashion. I had hoped cooperation would start it, but it didn't.
What about with Justice Thomas? A number of members of the House have called for his impeachment. What do you think about that?
There's only been one attempt in history to impeach a Supreme Court justice. It was in the year 1804. The impeachment went through in the House and it was defeated in the Senate. So there's not a lot of precedent for that kind of activity. It'd make a nice headline, but I'm trying to really be an author of real change here, trying to work, hoping that either Chief Justice Roberts will come around or other associate justices will say, we don't want to be painted with the same brush as Clarence Thomas. We don't do these things. We may have made a mistake here or there, but for goodness sakes, let's clear up this mess. I hope that sentiment prevails.
And what would that look like? I mean, are we talking about some sort of independent ethics commission, the way Illinois has a courts commission that can actually evaluate complaints about the justices?
Well, there is a judicial council that Chief Justice Roberts sent some information to. They have some authority, but not as to the Supreme Court. It's quite possible that that would be the way to go. So it would be other federal judges who are empowered to investigate and, if necessary, prosecute those justices who are guilty of wrongdoing.
Scholars of the court have identified some issues beyond just these sort of ethical concerns we've been talking about. And one of those includes the increased use of what's known as the shadow docket, right? This is where it used to be that judges would get sort of last-minute death penalty appeals and they could very quickly issue an unsigned order, as you know. But we're seeing that more and more. The Texas abortion bounty law a few years ago was that. Should Congress be looking at Can Congress look at reining in this use of these unsigned orders, unexplained orders?
It's a good question. I don't think it's clear what the answer is. We do have authority over the court. The number of justices is decided by law, not by the Constitution. The budget for the court is passed by Congress. So we have a lot of ways to communicate politically with the Supreme Court. In terms of the shadow docket, to me, it is an affront to the people of this country. If you are going to make critical decisions of historic importance, you should explain them. It doesn't have to be 10 pages long, but at least let us know what you're thinking. This raises the question as to whether or not there's something going on behind the scenes. No court wants that suggestion looming over them.
Although the U.S. Supreme Court doesn't seem too troubled by it, right? Or at least a majority on the court.
But the cumulative evidence on the ethics front, as well as the shadow docket and other issues, has really taken its toll on the reputation of the court. And when it gets right down to it, that's what the court has to rely on. Courts make controversial decisions, and they usually get by with it because people say, well, it is the Supreme Court. It's the highest court of the land. If they start questioning the integrity of the court, we're in for trouble.
Well, and that actually gets at something else I wanted to ask about, because there, Justice Alito, for example, has been making speeches sort of criticizing people who he says are trying to undermine the legitimacy of the U.S. Supreme Court. Do you think the U.S. Supreme Court is losing legitimacy?
Yes. And I'll tell you why. There was a concerted, organized, well-funded effort by a group called the Federalist Society, a man named Leonard Leo. And their goal was to make certain that their types of judges were chosen at every single level, including the Supreme Court. Just a mere coincidence that during the Trump administration, every judge, every nominee for judge proposed by them had been a member of the Federalist Society. I can't tell you how many times I asked these nominees, so tell me about the Federalists. Oh, we just get together for lunch. It doesn't mean that much. And baloney. There's something going on here. They had to pass a litmus test for Leonard Leo to get the Federalist Society support, which ultimately led to their approval before the United States Senate. So he had a concerted effort. He's invested hundreds of millions of dollars into that effort, literally, and has more to follow. And so the question's been raised politically, this has never happened in history, where one political group spent so much money to make sure that their type of judge was chosen. So I'm sorry that Justice Alito worries about the image of the court. He should have thought about that when he appeared before us.
But he's talking about progressive critics, right? And people who talk about expanding the number of justices. And even I think some of his colleagues, Justice Sotomayor, who's made raised questions about the consistency of the way in which some of these shadow docket decisions come out. Where do you draw the line about what is appropriate criticism of questionable practices by the justices versus, you know, what he's talking about?
Well, I can tell you've already run into that with Clarence Thomas. And they said, well, you're just going after him, having a hearing, raising all these questions because you don't like recent decisions like the Dobbs decision or the Bruin decision. I then pulled out the letter and said the first letter I sent on this subject was 11 years ago. So I've been asking these questions about the same justice ever since then, long before those decisions were handed down. I think it gets to the heart of the matter. They want to assign some political agenda that's a cabal going after and harassing this justice. It's a problem that's been there for a long time, and I raised it in writing, and I've got the letter to prove it.
This is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We're listening to a conversation I recorded Monday afternoon with Illinois U.S. Senator Dick Durbin. He's chairman of the Judiciary Committee. I should note, a few minutes ago in the conversation, he mentioned that the Judiciary Committee had not yet received a response letter from the Republican billionaire Harlan Crow, who has given millions of dollars worth of travel and gifts and tuition for a nephew to U.S. Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas. He mentioned that Crow had not yet responded to a request for information. Apparently, that response did come in at some point because this morning, Senator Durbin put out a statement under the Judiciary Committee saying that it was an inadequate response. Quote, Harlan Crow believes the secrecy of his lavish gifts to Justice Thomas is more important than the reputation of the highest court of law in this land. He is wrong, end quote. That said, let's continue listening to my interview with Senator Durbin. So sticking with the subject of the judiciary, but looking at confirmations here, again, as you well know, a smaller Democratic majority has slowed the pace of judicial confirmations this year, particularly some health-related challenges of Senators John Fetterman of Pennsylvania, Dianne Feinstein of California. Senator Fetterman is back, while Senator Feinstein has been slower to return. And there have been some calls for her to step down. What do you think of that?
Well, there are several questions there. The first thing is, 2 years ago, when Joe Biden became president, a little over 2 years ago, we had an evenly split Senate, and I was chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee. We approved a record number of judicial nominees in that two-year period of time. Now we have, I kind of laugh, a comfortable margin of 51-49 in the Senate. And I have a one-vote margin in the Senate Judiciary Committee where it was previously tied. And we're still keeping up with that pace. So we have good nominees. We have bipartisan support for many of them. But when it gets right down to it, if somebody's going to go to their son or daughter's high school commencement, and that just recently happened, or someone is off in a hospital for counseling for depression, like one of the senators was, or your situation with Dianne Feinstein facing shingles at her age, it's an interruption where we have to take into consideration how many votes are going to be on the floor. So there are times we have to delay. We recently delayed 8 weeks for the return of Senator Feinstein, and four judges were approved as soon as she came back.
But 8 weeks, I mean, out of, you know, the functional time that the Senate has to act on these nominations, as you know better than I do, is pretty limited. That's a real setback.
It is. It's a challenge for sure. And you have to count the votes on the floor after you get them out of the committee. But these things have happened. In my Senate career, my colleague from Illinois, Mark Kirk, had a stroke. He was physically absent from the Senate for a year. I know because I did my best to cover for him, tried to help him all I could. It happens. It happens on both sides of the aisle. So, you know, you have to deal with that reality.
People say Senator Feinstein had a great career going back to her time in the Board, was it the Board of Supervisors of San Francisco? But they are saying, you know, maybe she should step aside and let someone else get in there. What do you think of that?
It's a decision she has to make herself with her family. I'm her friend, her colleague. We sat next to one another for over 20 years on the same committee. I respect her so much. I'm sorry she's going through what she's going through. She's announced she's not running for re-election, but what she does next is really her call.
Is she competent to make that decision? There are people who are raising questions about that.
I don't know that I can answer that. I would just say that in the recent committee hearing that we had on new legislation to help police be more effective in keeping our home safe, she asked for recognition. I recognized her. She gave a very lucid and positive statement about the pending legislation off the cuff. So those who write her off have to take into consideration that there are moments where she shows that she understands everything that's happening.
Is there a broader lesson in there for you and your colleagues about, you know, when it's time to accept the thanks of a grateful nation for public service and make way for a new generation?
Of course there is. You know, we're all human, and there are people much younger in a more compromised state than the people I serve with. There are people older than me by 10 years who are still making a great contribution, like Republican Chuck Grassley in Iowa. He just got reelected. The people of Iowa said, we like Chuck and we like what he's doing. I can tell you, sitting next to him on the Republican side for 2 years, he was on the ball the entire time.
Okay, we need to take a break. When we return, the conclusion of my interview of Illinois U.S. Senator Dick Durbin, recorded Monday afternoon. We're going to talk about his long relationship, sometimes frustrating, with Republican Senator Lindsey Graham, as well as Ukraine and the debt ceiling fight. That's coming up after a short break. You're listening to The 21st Show. Do stay with us. It's The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We're continuing to listen back to my conversation recorded Monday afternoon with Illinois U.S. Senator Dick Durbin. In part one, we focused on his work on the Judiciary Committee, his Republican counterpart there. Durbin is chairman, the ranking member, the ranking Republican is U.S. Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, who has become a polarizing figure, to say the least, in the Trump era. He was once an anti-Trump Republican, and he has become one of the president's, former president's, biggest backers to date. And I was curious about how Durbin reckons with his relationship with Graham.
You talked about the split Judiciary Committee, and I noticed a recent confirmation had a single, passed with a single Republican vote. And this was former federal prosecutor and now Judge Aurelia Merchant, if I'm saying that right, of New York. But the Republican vote came from Senator Lindsey Graham. And I wanted to ask you about him because you've served with him in the Senate for many years now, again, chairman, ranking member on the Judiciary, and in co-sponsoring immigration legislation. And I'm bringing him up because he's kind of become this symbol of what has changed in the Republican Party in the past decade or so. I don't know if you saw the news site, The Bulwark, recently published a close examination of his career, sort of thought of him as an exemplar of people who were once against what President Trump stood for and really made to accommodate themselves to him over the years. And I wonder, what do you make of Senator Graham? Has he changed in your view?
He's my personal friend, and he's been that for a long time. And when I say that to my members of my family and friends, I say, are you kidding me? Lindsey Graham? Yes. He's been co-sponsor of the DREAM Act, a bill that's important to me. I've had pending for 20 years in the Senate. And he's worked constructively. We were together in the Gang of Eight, the bipartisan immigration reform. We worked together in lobbying President Trump on immigration. The list goes on. And he now is the ranking Republican member on my committee. And we have a good, strong working relationship and a trust of one another. Now, there are moments when he is off on his thing. And I don't know exactly when they're coming, and I don't know how far he's going to go. But he doesn't sound like the same Lindsey to me, and I'm sure he says the same thing about me sometimes. But we have a good, positive relationship. It's hard for people to understand that when you're in a body of 100 people and any one person can stop the train at any moment, there's a dependency which emerges there. And when the opposite is true, someone on the other side comes to your rescue and keeps you moving forward. You don't forget it. Personal relationships mean a lot.
And maybe you can't say or don't want to say, but I mean, do you ever say, like, what the heck are you doing as you watch him defending? I mean, it's really striking when you sort of see it lined up from 2015 to 2016 to today, how much he's changed on what he publicly says about the former president, for example.
Oh, for sure. He's one of the most outspoken critics of Donald Trump before Trump was elected, and then became one of his closest allies. It says something about both men, and I'll let psychologists explain exactly what it says.
I know our time is limited today, so I also want to ask you about Ukraine. The journalist Anne Applebaum recently had a piece in The Atlantic in which she reported that there are some in the Ukrainian government who suspect that the U.S., there are some in the U.S. government who don't really want them to win, right? If winning means really dealing a solid defeat to Russia, taking back Crimea, maybe destroying the Black Sea Fleet. Does the U.S. government really want Ukraine to win?
This president and his government, his administration, clearly do. I am the co-chair of the Ukraine caucus in the United States Senate. I'm convinced of that. I have no doubts about it. Are there other members of Congress, particularly on the other side of the aisle, who feel differently? Yes, for sure. You can see it. And it's no surprise that when Putin puts his list of 500 people who are not welcome into the Russia, as long as he's in charge, it has a long list of people who are critical of Donald Trump, including Raffensperger, the Secretary of State in Georgia. What the heck does he have to do with the Ukrainian foreign policy? I don't know. Nothing, literally. He has a lot to do with Trump's reputation after that last election.
But I think what the Ukrainians were telling Anne Applebaum, at least, is that even the people who are publicly supporting Ukraine maybe would put the brakes on. I mean, if Ukraine is successful in this spring campaign, maybe I'll say it, what would a victory for Ukraine look like?
Russia out of the territory of Ukraine, a restoration of their territorial integrity. I think that's that would be the starting point if they asked me. But the bottom line is, what I care is not important. They have to decide what the parameters of peace will look like.
And when you say territorial integrity, 2022 January borders or 2014 before the Russian invasion of Crimea?
2014.
And do you think the U.S. – so you don't think the U.S. should stop Ukraine, the Ukrainian people, if they start pushing into Crimea?
Well, let me say this. That was an invasion that was not provoked, just the same as the invasion of Ukraine itself. I look at this a little different than some. My mother was an immigrant to this country from Lithuania. The Baltic states are the next most vulnerable piece of real estate when it comes to the future of Russia. If we don't stop Putin in Ukraine, we can fully expect his adventurism to reach into the Baltics and beyond. So I think there's a lot at stake here, and he has to be stopped. I'm glad the NATO alliance under Joe Biden's leadership has been stronger than ever in saying the same thing.
Last topic I think we'll have time for today. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen says we could hit the X date for the debt ceiling as soon as June 1st. Why not have eliminated the debt ceiling back when Democrats controlled both chambers of Congress and the presidency?
I'm looking at my Constitution here, and I hope you'll bear with me.
That's all right.
This is the 14th Amendment, Section 4, which says, and I abbreviate a little bit of it, the validity of the public debt of the United States authorized by law shall not be questioned. It's unequivocal. But the question is, why do we go through this suicide pact and this terrible political suffering with regularity? Because there are some who want to use it as a lever to achieve a political goal. Right now, it's Speaker McCarthy as Republican leader of the House. I look back on things and say, where was this fiscal conservatism under the Trump administration? Under President Trump, we increased the national debt of the United States by $8 trillion. 25% of the entire accumulated debt of the United States occurred under that one president. I didn't hear any screams and howls of despair and anguish from the Republican side. And as a Democrat, I was voting to extend the debt ceiling because for us to default on our debt would be catastrophic for our economy. So they're playing the card now, at least Speaker McCarthy is, and I hope they come to their senses before it's too late.
Do you think we'll go over the cliff?
We're getting perilously close to it. As we record this, we're just hours away from the president returning from Japan, meeting with Speaker McCarthy. I hope that they can reach an agreement because we're right up against the deadline of June 1st.
Senator Durbin, thank you for your time.
Good to be with you.